Hello, welcome to EI Talks, the podcast that takes ideas seriously. I'm Paul Lay, senior editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and I'm delighted to say that today I'm joined by Dmitry Alperovich. I think it's fair to say that, Dmitry, you're a man of many parts. You're one of the leading thinkers on geopolitics and national security, co-founder and executive chairman of Silverado Policy Accelerator, a leading think tank. You're a member of the US government's Cyber Safety Review Board and also presenter of the podcast Geopolitics Decanted. So welcome.
Thanks so much, Paul.
Well, we're here principally to talk about the book you co-authored, remarkable book, with Garrett Graff, which is World on the Brink, How America Can Beat China in the 21st Century. But just before we get to discuss that book, I wonder if I might ask you to give us a brief resume of your life, because it's rather extraordinary. And I think it adds some context to your thinking, perhaps, too, as well.
Sure. Well, really great to be with you. I'm an immigrant to this country, to America. I was born in the former Soviet Union in Moscow, immigrated as a child to the United States, but lived long enough under the communist authoritarian government to appreciate the threat that these types of regimes present and to not get lulled into thinking that there can be agreements with them that they will actually honor unless you really enforce those agreements. I had spent the first part of my career in the technology sector, particularly cybersecurity. I co-founded one of the largest cybersecurity companies in the world, CrowdStrike. And for the last 15 years, really had focused in the cybersecurity realm on the nation state threat. It came to my attention in 2010 when I was called by a small company called Google to help investigate an intrusion into their networks from the Chinese government. That intrusion also impacted many other companies around the United States and was the first time that the public, the broader public, learned about the fact that cyber was not just about teenagers in their basements stealing credit cards or defacing websites, but you had intelligence agencies, you had militaries that were doing this. We were involved in the investigation of the 2016 elections, the hacks by Russia. I was involved in an investigation of major hacks from Iran and North Korea as well. And really, the concerns around Chinese espionage starting in 2010 is what drove me to get really, really concerned about where this competition, as some call it, but I call Cold War II, with China was going. And I said back in 2011 that what they're doing to U.S. industry and other Western industries represents the greatest transfer of wealth in history. They're stealing everything that's not bolted down, intellectual property, trade secrets, and the like, in order to enable to better compete against us. It's essentially economic warfare. And for many years, the U.S. government basically ignored it. Yeah. And only in recent years did they start managing it more effectively with indictments and sanctions and what have you. Still a lot more to do, but that's how I came at it from the perspective of early realization that China was a huge problem, and then started focusing on other aspects of that competition, including military, the issues of Taiwan, and so forth.
Mm. And we're recording this podcast in Washington, D.C. We both at the Henry A. Kissinger and the Question of World Order conference, and the topic of American-Chinese rivalry has been absolutely central to almost all the discussions that have taken place, all the panels that have taken place here. And I think it's fair to say, Dmitry, that you take a rather robust view of this, drawing direct parallels between, as you say, Cold War II and the original Cold War with Russia, which is a contentious claim, as we've seen with the various debates. I mean, why do you draw that parallel so strongly?
Well, I believe it's just objectively factual. When you look and compare and contrast, as we do in the book, the first Cold War and the second, they're nearly identical on every level, right? We have a global competition for supremacy with China that plays out in every corner of the world, in every realm of that competition, whether it's military, diplomatic, geopolitical, technological, economic, you name it. We have an arms race, a conventional arms race, by the way, and a nuclear arms race, as both countries are rebuilding their nuclear arsenals, and China is actually massively expanding theirs, particularly in this decade and beyond. You have a scramble for military bases. The United States, for the first time in 32 years, is going back into the Philippines. We're expanding our presence in Guam and Japan and other places around Australia in the region. China's doing the same thing in Djibouti and Pakistan and Cambodia and so forth. You have a space race, right? The defining moment of the first Cold War was the race to the moon. What are we doing right now? Trying to get to the moon before the Chinese do. You have a tech competition, an economic competition, a spy war that eclipses anything we had seen during the first Cold War, not according to me, but according to the FBI director that says that the level of espionage against the United States, both economic and national security, is unprecedented, in part enabled by China. You have an ideological competition, and not just communism versus capitalism, but certainly authoritarian versus democracy, right, that President Biden has talked a lot about. You have alliance blocks forming, right? At this conference, there's talk about this axis of upheaval, China getting a lot closer with Russia, with North Korea, with Iran, against us, similar to what you had seen during the first Cold War. So on virtually every level, this is a conflict that's nearly identical to the first one. And the only argument I hear against that label is, well, look at the economic interconnectivity between the two countries. And on the face of it, I find it kind of a ridiculous argument because I've just given you a dozen reasons for how the conflict's identical, and you just have one on the other side that is supposed to completely eclipse all the others. And even when you dig into it, you realize that the two systems during the first Cold War, Soviet Union and the West, were not completely disconnected. There were lots and lots of economic connections, particularly around fossil fuels. Starting with the 1960s, there was pipelines that were built to provide gas and oil to Western Europe, and Western Europe had become much more reliant on that, as we've seen that continued into this conflict with Ukraine. You had wheat that was being sold to the Soviet Union that was really fundamental to them. You know, I remember growing up, the lot of cars that were so famous in the Soviet Union, they were produced by Fiat, that licensed the technology to the Soviet Union. Much of the industrial base of the Soviet Union was built by Western industrialists, German, British, the United States. One interesting fact that most people don't know about this current conflict with Ukraine is that when Russia first invaded, they decimated this southern city of Mariupol, where brave Ukrainian defenders were holed up in this massive steel factory, Azovstal, making their last stand. While that factory was built in the 1930s, it is an exact copy of a factory in Gary, Indiana. An American industrialist came over to help build Stalin a steel factory to produce tanks and aircraft and all kinds of things, because why wouldn't you, right? So it is remarkable how similar that relationship was with the relationship with China. Scale is different. I'm not going to argue that. The level of trade between the United States and China is unprecedented historically. But by the way, that is changing now, as decoupling, at least partial decoupling, is in progress.
And very important to the book World on the Brink is the speculative hypothesis that you put there, which is set in the wake of a presidential election, a US presidential election in 2028, which focuses on Taiwan, which again you draw parallels with the events in the late 1940s in West Berlin and the blockade there. Can you tell us about that hypothesis, how it works out, scenario?
This is another similarity between the two Cold Wars, is that you have a regional flashpoint. West Berlin was that flashpoint, at least for the first 15 years of the Cold War, where it was the one place in the world where the United States was willing to go to war, including a nuclear war, with the Soviet Union, right? And it's not just the blockade in the 1940s and the airlift, but President Kennedy in 1961, after the meeting with Khrushchev in June in Vienna, came away completely shocked because Khrushchev presented an ultimatum that the United States and allies had to withdraw from West Berlin or he was going to kick us out by force. And President Kennedy, throughout that whole summer, was preparing for a nuclear war with the Soviet Union. He went on television and told the American public that we're going to fight for West Berlin, including with nuclear weapons. He told Congress to authorize additional funding for fallout shelters and to get ready for a nuclear conflict. That's how critically he thought West Berlin was to American credibility and the ability to ultimately defend West Germany and the broader Western Europe. That is Taiwan today. President Xi is not hiding his ambition to unify with Taiwan. Just days ago, he said that there are blood ties between the Chinese and Taiwanese people. I'm reminded of another leader, authoritarian leader, that talked about blood ties with German people around the world. It's a very troubling comparison. He talks about the need to unify with Taiwan and achieve the rejuvenation of the Chinese nation by force if necessary. He says that this is not a problem, quote unquote, that needs to be passed to the future generations. So I'm convinced that this is a man that is intent on taking Taiwan peacefully if he can. After all, as Clausewitz once quoted Napoleon, every aggressor is peaceful in that he wants to take over his neighbors without opposition, without armed opposition. And that is Xi Jinping. But if he can't do it, I believe he will invade. And he wants to do it on his own watch. Mm. I don't think he wants to go into the pantheon of history without his legacy cemented by taking Taiwan. And if you agree with that premise, the man just turned 70. He's looking at the next decade or so of his life in power, potentially his even longevity. And the window, I think, does open up in 2028. It's not that I think that he definitely invades in 2028, but he's going to look at that 28 through 32 roughly period, I think, as the likely opportunity to invade. And then it'll be based on tactical situations, his capability, the capability of the Taiwanese, the U.S., Japanese forces that he's likely to see oppose him.
And so if we in the West don't think it's a Cold War II, he does.
Oh, I think he's absolutely convinced of that. And in fact, you hear him talk about both publicly and privately to the Chinese Communist Party members that the United States is containing China, which, by the way, he's absolutely right. We are. Mm-hmm. We're just not willing to admit it. So I think that China is under no illusions that this is a Cold War. And the other reason to label it officially a Cold War II is that the only people we're deluding are not the Chinese, who know exactly what this is, but we're deluding the American public. And without being able to tell the American public what this competition, quote unquote, truly is. After all, this is not, you know, a marathon in the Olympics where it's okay if China gets a gold medal. Yeah. It's not great, but it's not the end of the world. This is, I think, an existential fight that we must win. It's a fight for the 21st century. And by not coming clear with the American people, coming out with the label that this is a Cold War, it's hard to get their support for the tough measures, including economically tough measures that it will take to win it.
And why do you think there's a reluctance to confront the reality from U.S. policymakers, U.S. politicians?
Well, I think there are political realities. You know, I think in the Democratic administrations, they're very concerned about the left flank, and that part of the party does not want to acknowledge, you know, Cold Wars. They weren't fans. Big fans of the first one either. I think in the Republican side, there's much greater willingness. And I think, you know, if Trump gets into office, they might very well label it a Cold War II. But the reality is that when you get people privately in this town, most policymakers, most people on the Hill, they'll admit to you that it's a Cold War. And it's just an argument of whether you talk about it publicly or not.
And you have a strategy of opposition, of long-term opposition, which I think is a repetition of one word, delay. Delay, delay, delay. Can you explain that to us?
So if you concede my premise that we're in a Cold War II with China, then the question becomes, how do you win it? And what does victory even look like? Mm. And this is where I think that you have the greatest difference between the two Cold Wars. The great insight of George Kennan, the architect of the strategy for winning the first Cold War, was that the Soviet Union is a natural phenomena, and you can just wait them out. Because one day it will collapse because it's this amalgamation of ethnic nations and countries that were put together by force, and one day it will disappear, which is exactly, of course, what happened. Well, China is not going to disappear, right? It's been around for 5,000 years. It's a homogeneous society. It will be around probably for another 5,000 years or longer. Chinese Communist Party may not disappear for maybe centuries, right? It would be nice if it did, but there's nothing we can do to change that outcome. I'm certainly not in favor of regime change operations in China or anything of the sort. So I think you have to come at it from the premise that China will exist and CCP may very well exist for a very, very long time. So this confrontation may take place over many decades, but the way you win it is by making sure that we are the dominant power in the world. And we preserve all of our advantages, economic advantages first and foremost, which will drive our military advantages and alliances and so forth. And there we have some similarities with the first Cold War because I believe that China is on an unsustainable path. When you look at their economy, it is already down to single-digit growth, slightly above the U.S. growth rate. But, of course, their GDP is 25% smaller on nominal terms. So at that rate, they will never catch up to the United States unless something dramatic changes here or there. They have an enormous problem with the fact that their economy is completely reliant on exports. Mm. And you have not just the United States, but many other countries, including, by the way, their friends or so-called friends in the BRICS. starting to implement protectionist measures. Countries like Turkey, countries like India, Brazil, and others, they're saying, wait a second, your overcapacity is decimating our industrial base, and we're not going to let you do that. So China is confronting a very tough geopolitical environment going forward. It has not invested in domestic consumption to try to diversify its economy. It has an enormous real estate bubble. At the height of 2008, real estate was about 10 to 11% of the U.S. economy. Today in China, it's 30%. And mostly speculative with ghost cities and the like that people are well aware of. And then on top of all of that, you have an enormous demographic problem that is going to manifest itself in a really terrible way, and it's going to be a huge drag on the economy and very deflationary for decades to come. When you think about the social upheaval that this might cause, China will very likely go from 1.4 billion people it has today to just 500 million by the end of the century. Mm. Now, 500 million is still a lot of people. And, you know, the United States right now is about 330 million. Yeah. So we should not underestimate what you can do from a military perspective with that number of people. But in terms of economic growth, this is going to be just absolutely devastating to them. And if they're not going to be the leading economic power, then everything else in terms of the threat that they present will fold into the background, right? Just like, you know, China was confrontational to us for much of the first Cold War until the 1970s, but they simply did not have the economic power to be a huge problem for us. And if we could get them back in a box, if you will, and not present a regional or even a global threat to us, then we can manage this confrontation and avoid war.
And you present a number of battlefields, battlegrounds, in this economic and technological battle between the US and China, most of which you suggest the US is winning by some distance. But there are battlegrounds where the US is not winning. And I think in particular, when we're looking at semiconductors, particularly foundational ones, as you can explain that to our listeners later, and things like critical minerals as well, where the US has fallen behind China, you seem to suggest.
We are, but mostly because we allow them to do so. Yeah. And in almost every one of these cases, whether it's critical minerals, green energy technologies like solar, wind, batteries, in foundational chips, which are these sometimes called mature legacy chips, they're 28 nanometers and above roughly, they're actually critical to absolutely everything. Yeah. They're indeed foundational. China is winning because they are subsidizing their industries. They're engaging in dumping on our markets, driving our companies out of business. And they are cheating by stealing intellectual property. And they've done that in every single one of those sectors, minus critical minerals, where they established a lead early on in the 1980s for refining and processing. All of this is solvable with trade measures that are longstanding.
So you're talking about tariffs.
Tariffs and export controls as well, and other trade retaliatory measures against illegal dumping and subsidization of these markets to allow domestic industries to compete. And you're seeing the Biden administration continuing what the Trump administration really began in some of these areas. They've just announced in May of this year new tariffs going on EVs, on batteries, on some critical minerals, semiconductors. So this is starting to get through our policy establishment that you can't just let China dominate these fields. And we need to respond by creating barriers that will allow our existing companies to innovate and not compete with someone that is literally dumping the stuff on your shores. I'll give you one concrete example, rare earths. Rare earths is actually not a huge problem if we apply the right policy solutions to it. In the United States, we have one of the oldest rare earth mines in existence. It's a mine called Mountain Pass in California, right on the border of Nevada, about 45 minutes outside of Las Vegas, that I visited recently. And that mine has been producing rare earths since the 1940s. It has been crucial to our space race, to our military programs for the last half century. And that mine now is producing 15% of the world's rare earths, more than enough for most U.S. needs and many allied needs. What it's not doing is processing or refining those minerals. It's shipping them to China. The company that owns that mine, MP Materials, started a few years ago processing and refining on site. It's not a rocket science process. It's been known for many decades. It's not hard to do. What has happened? The two leading Chinese companies that own 90% of the rare earth refining and processing started dumping to drive them out of business. In fact, those two companies that have the monopoly on rare earth processing are both showing losses. If you have a monopoly, why would you be showing losses? It's because they're trying to drive them out of business. Well, we can't let that happen. This is just plain fairness. I mean, forget the geopolitical competition, forget the Cold War. You can't let someone compete unfairly against you this way. You have to remedy it with trade measures. This is not protectionism. This is just fair trade, right? If someone is not competing against you fairly, you can't have fair trade. You can't have free trade. And this is happening in every category. China told one of our trade negotiators back 10 years ago when we were complaining about solar panel dumping. At the time, we still had a solar industry. They said, go ahead and sue us in the WTO. By the time that lawsuit makes its way through the system, your industry will be destroyed. Yeah. Guess what happened? Our industry now is destroyed because of Chinese behavior. We have to retaliate. We have to build protectionist borders in those industries that Chinese have destroyed through this unfair competition to allow innovation, to allow companies to compete and grab to the US market, which is the largest market in the world.
And the aim would be, in things like AI, in high tech, to have some kind of US monopoly on those technologies.
Yes, I think we want to be the leaders in four critical technology areas: AI and autonomy, biotech and synthetic biology, space technology, and green energy. Today, in three of those four, we are the leaders. Mm. And in some of them, particularly AI, we're by far the leaders.
Yeah, yeah.
All of the so-called frontier foundation models are made by US companies.
Yeah.
That's not an accident. In green energy, we're losing badly for the reasons that I've just described, but it's not insurmountable. I've talked to many companies in Silicon Valley and elsewhere that are inventing new battery technologies, inventing new modular nuclear reactors, working on issues of fusion. So what they want is ability to compete, and they can't compete with companies that are getting subsidized by China and they're selling below cost, right? So you have to create an equal playing field for them to develop those technologies and take them to market.
And also, in parallel with the last Cold War, this new Cold War, this Cold War II, as you call it, Dmitry, this economic and technological battle, although it focuses on the conflict between US and China, if your strategy unfolds in terms of this kind of monopoly, this dominance in the tech that you talk about, that becomes a means of forming coalitions, of creating allies, because they then presumably have access to that technology that the US has. I mean, we think of AUKUS being a classic early example of that.
That's exactly right. AUKUS, right? We have the best nuclear-powered submarines in the world. We're entering into agreement with the United Kingdom and Australia to share that most sensitive technology, one of the most sensitive technologies we have in the United States, in order to build a closer partnership, leveraging the production capacity of our allies, joint research to further that innovation. You can see us doing that in AI, in biotech, and lots of these different areas, picking friendly partners, partners that have a lot to add from their own industrial bases, their own innovative companies, where we can tighten up those alliances and make sure it's a win-win for everyone. Mm-hmm. You know, when China says win-win, they mean China wins twice.
Yeah.
When we say win-win, we actually want our friends to win and share in our benefits.
And that AUKUS, of course, because of where Australia is located, where the US Pacific Fleet is located, becomes crucial to the security of Taiwan as well.
Absolutely. So the first part of AUKUS is already going into place, and that is actually not even the technological piece of it, but the access to the submarine bases in Western Australia for US nuclear subs, dramatically shortening the distance, of course, to the potential conflict area. That is really, really important. The additional capacity to produce submarines, and submarines will be absolutely vital for this conflict in order to try to sink the Chinese invasion fleet as it tries to cross the Taiwan Strait, building up greater shipbuilding capacity, both in the United States and the United Kingdom and Australia, is absolutely vital. The projections from a think tank in Australia are that by 2028, we'll have 50% more Virginia-class nuclear submarines on station in the region than we do today because of AUKUS, and by mid-2030s, it will be 100% more. Mm. So that is real benefits, not just to us and to our partners, but to Taiwan, Japan, and other countries that fear this Chinese invasion.
Mm. And you also imply, there's a lot of talk, as you said, about the axis of chaos, whatever you want to call it, the Legion of Doom, I heard it called today, which is, as you say, this vague coalition between China, Iran, North Korea, and Russia.
I actually don't love that term because I don't think that alliance is as close as it's been portrayed.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Either you seem to say that it's not a primus inter pares, China. It's wholly dominant in terms of this, and it's not really a coalition at all.
Yeah, first of all, the only alliance, if you will, that exists amongst those four countries is one that was just established, I guess reestablished, by Russia and North Korea to have a mutual defense treaty. Iran and Russia or China don't have a mutual defense treaty.
Yeah.
In fact, the mutual distrust that exists between Russia and China is at an all-time high.
Yeah, it's profound.
The number one source of prosecutions in Russia for espionage cases are actually people being accused of spying for China, not even the United States, right? So that tells you a lot about the state of this relationship. And yes, China is covertly helping Russia in this conflict in Ukraine. There's news that's been recently published that they're going to be producing long-range drones for Russia, attack drones. They're investing heavily in Russian military industrial base, but they're not providing weapons. They're not sending people to fight in Ukraine. They have a very much hands-off approach to this, and they're only doing what's in the interest of China. Mm-hmm. It's very much a self-interested motivation that they have here. So this creates opportunity for us to not pull Russia away or, you know, do reverse Kissinger, as some have suggested. I don't think there's any prospect for that whatsoever. But the more that we can kind of drive conflict between all of these parties, you know, the weaker that this axis, as some call it, will become.
Mm. And I wonder about the question of values. There's a lot of talk at this conference about America's values, about Western values. How important are they to winning this second Cold War?
Well, I don't think we should compromise our values and what makes us Americans to win it. And that was one of George Kennan's also guidance principles, that you don't want to beat the Soviet Union by becoming them. So I think that's really important. But, you know, I come, again, maybe it's my background, having been born in an authoritarian country, but also as a businessman, that the most important value is winning. You don't want to lose.
Yeah.
I hate losing. It's not even about winning. It's about not losing to me. That's really critical. And that's why this Cold War narrative, I think, becomes so important, is that you want to tell the American public, you want to tell our allies, this is a confrontation that we're in, and we're going to win it. Mm. There's no question about it.
Yeah. That was actually the last question I was going to ask you, is who is going to win the second Cold War?
I think we have every single advantage over China. In fact, I'm puzzled when people are hesitant to call it a Cold War because, by the way, we have a great track record of winning Cold Wars. And I argue in the book that the Soviet Union was much, much stronger than China on almost every level except the economy. Their military was way stronger. They had the Warsaw Pact alliance system that China does not have. They had a much bigger landmass that spanned Asia and Europe. They had a navy that traversed the world's oceans. China doesn't have any of those advantages.
And they had serious experience of warfare as well.
Absolutely. I mean, they took Berlin in 1945. They took on the Nazis and largely were responsible for beating them, right, and taking on the brunt of that fight in World War II. And they were much more self-sufficient for most of the Cold War. China is highly reliant on the export markets and imports, by the way, on the West. So on virtually every level, they're weaker than most people think that they are. So this is doable. We have every single advantage. The overarching question that I'm not able to answer in the book, and we will see it play out both in this election and going forward, is do we have the political will to do so?
Yeah. Well, thank you for ending on that optimistic note, Dmitry. And thank you very much for talking with us. It's been fascinating, as is your book, which is a wonderful read, On the Brink. I highly recommend it. It's a fantastic scenario and very, very thought-provoking. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me, Paul.
Thank you.
You've been listening to EI Talks, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast. Engelsberg Ideas is funded by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation for Public Benefit. The sound engineer is Gareth Jones, and EI Talks is produced by Alistair Benn. Till next time, thanks for listening.